Today is Saturday, November 13, 1993. This interview will be conducted at the Lemon Residence at 4375 Willis Street, W-I-L-L-I-S, Ackworth, A-C-W-O-R-T-H, Georgia. Home telephone 404-917-0177. I expect that the interview will be conducted with Mr. and Mrs. Lemon and their son. Dr. Gentile originally heard of this home as of historical interest when he was reading a brochure of a walking tour of historical residences in Ackworth approximately a month ago. I contacted Mrs. Lemon, she and her husband own the house currently, and arranged for this interview. This interview will be conducted with Mark Lemon and his mother, Martha Lemon.
Okay. First of all, I think I'd like to start back in terms of how the house was built and who built the house and why and some of the whatever you want to tell me about the origin of the home.
Okay. The house was built by James Lyle Lemon in 1856. My understanding is he had it built for himself and his wife that he had recently just married, Eliza Jane Davenport.
Was he from Ackworth?
He was born in DeKalb County in 1835 and moved to Cobb County in, I think, when he was about 8 or 9 years old. When he was 21, 1856 is when this house was built. So he had probably just married, 21 years old, and had built this house.
And what was his occupation at that time?
He was in business. I believe he had a general mercantile business. He was in business. He had several areas of interest. He and his brother Smith. He had a brother by the name of Smith Lemon, who I think in the 1850s, Smith was a little older than he was, and Smith opened up the first bank in this town. It was the Smith Lemon Banking Company.
In Ackworth,
right up the street here.
The building is still there, the Lemon Building is still there.
He was in business with his brother in several different activities, mercantile, dry goods, banking. They sort of had a variety of things going on at the time.
Let me interrupt you because of the don't want that to be obvious, but I have to be able to hear. That's young to open a bank and a mercantile business. Were they from a prosperous family?
I don't think you could say that they were wealthy. They were certainly industrious. I know that their father, I want to say James is his name, but I might need to get verification on this by looking at the family tree up there. But their father was heavily involved in county politics down in DeKalb County. I think they built the first frame house in DeKalb County. He was the county treasurer for several years. So I don't think they were very wealthy, but they weren't paupers either. I'd say they were upper middle class. Would probably be the best way to put them. I know that they're dynamic people. They were really interested in, were probably very interested in becoming wealthy. They came up here and saw the opportunity to open up.
The brothers.
Mm-hmm. Well, they did. They came up with their father. The whole family moved
nine.
Up,
mm-hmm.
Right? And growing up in this area, they probably saw the opportunity to open several businesses and did so. They did everything from, like I said, mercantile, dry goods, general merchandise, banking. There was a tannery that they got involved in right across the road here. I think there was a cotton mill that they were working in. They had a gold they were mining for gold in the area, and that ties in later when they had $5,000 in gold hidden on the property here during the Civil War. And when they came back and re-inhabited this area, they were able to dig up the money and start fresh after the war. They still had money.
And that was from their own gold mining, right. But did that take place in Ackworth, the gold mining?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, they mined down on Proctor's Creek, which ran about half a mile back that way.
Mm-hmm.
So there were gold mines in this area.
Now, that was before the Civil War took place that the house was built.
Right, 5 years.
Then tell me about your great-grandfather's being in the Civil War and being in the military.
Okay. Well, being one of the slightly more prominent citizens in the area, or he was one of the group of prominent citizens in this area, just being well-known, everybody probably knew who he was. When the war started, a company of infantry was raised, which was very common for that period. In fact, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the company of infantry was raised before the war actually started, and existed before the war started because of the threat of war, the impending threat of war.
Mm-hmm.
They raised this company beforehand, and James was elected second lieutenant in the company, the company being approximately 100 men.
And those would have all been people from this area.
Right. They were all local guys right in this town.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the names you can still see on mailboxes around here. And they trained locally in this area for a few weeks, and then they went down to Kennesaw, which back then was called Big Shanty, to Camp McDonald, which was a military training camp that was set up in right off the railroad tracks down in Kennesaw. And that was staffed by cadets from the Georgia Military Institute, GMI. And these cadets helped train these recruits in the arts of, you know, marching and firing and so forth. And James and his company, in I think August of 1861, were shipped north on trains to Richmond, and from that point on, they were actively involved in the war.
Fighting for the Confederacy.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Did his wife stay here in the house?
Yeah, I believe she did, because I have a letter that he wrote to her when he was a prisoner. I know, the most interesting part of this whole story, the house and everything, is his experiences during the war, because he just went through an unbelievably dramatic set of circumstances and experiences. He was wounded badly and captured and so forth, and fought in every major battle that the Army of Northern Virginia fought in under Robert E. Lee. His unit was thickly involved in the worst of the fighting, and in almost every battle they took part in, played some key role in turning the table or turning the tide of events in that particular battle. They were a very, very good regiment, and fought really hard. They were a really high quality fighting unit, and they were in very, very important parts of the battles. For instance, they were behind the Stone Wall at Fredericksburg, which is so famous to Civil War historians. They were in the wheat field and peach orchard at Gettysburg. They broke through the Union lines at Gaines Mill at the end of the day, when Confederate troops had been charging that line all day long and not being able to break the lines. The 18th Georgia went in with Hood's Texans, and they broke through the line and turned the tide of the battle. They won the day. And then that's not even to get into his prisoner experiences when he was a prisoner. So he saw a lot and experienced a lot.
But you said before he went to war, he buried the $5,000 in gold in the yard.
I think that what I've heard is that Smith did that, and that they
the brother
his brother buried. I'm pretty sure about that, is what I've always heard.
Mm-hmm.
And that when they came back, they probably used that money jointly to get started again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, how many years was he in the war before he came home for good?
He was in for the duration, the entire war.
But part of that time he spent in captivity.
Right.
Well, did he come home from being in captivity, or
right.
was he? He did.
Okay. Yeah, he did. He was.
He was 600.
Yeah.
That she may not know that.
Well, okay. He was when Longstreet was sent to Tennessee on temporary assignment to help in the Eastern Theater of Operations. The 18th Georgia being under Longstreet went with him. And they took part in the attack at Knoxville, Tennessee, in November of 1863. It was November 29th, 1863. They conducted a pre-dawn assault on an earthen fortification on the outskirts of the city of Knoxville, held by the Union troops. It was one of the first times in the history of warfare where wire entanglements were used. Not meaning barbed wire, but like trip wire was strung. It was telegraph wire strung between tree trunks in a network. And in the darkness, the assaulting troops ran through that stuff and got all tripped up. And plus, it was freezing cold. It was muddy. It was dark. They had to chop their way through a whole line of fallen trees that had been lined up. So it was difficult just in getting to this fortification. Once they got there, it poured down into a ditch that had been like a moat without water in it that had been built around the fort. The men poured down into this thing and the surface that they had to climb up to get over and into the fort was covered with ice and mud, and they had not brought scaling ladders with them, so they had to try to scramble and dig and claw their way up to the top of this fort. Meanwhile, lit cannon shells were being rolled down into them and exploding amongst the troops, killing dozens at a time. It was just a mess. And according to James in his diary, he and a group of about 12 other men. I'm sure isolated incidents like this happened all around the fort. But he and a group of men were able to slowly gain just below the crest of the parapet. And he said he had to use his sword, plunging his sword into the mud and pulling himself up with it to get up on the outer part of the parapet. And right on sort of a signal, they rushed over and were met. They ran right into a volley of musket fire that killed the colonel of the regiment and killed almost everyone. He wrote that he moved forward firing his pistol, and then the next thing he knows he was unconscious. And what had happened, according to the military, the medical records that I got from the National Archives, was that he was shot with a 58 caliber mini ball that pierced his pharynx, and the ball passed just under his jaw, pierced his neck, and came out the other side. And of course he was instantly unconscious. I mean, it just the shock. He was dragged down into the fort and captured, and then sent to a medical a field hospital, and then was subsequently sent north through Ohio and across over to Delaware, where he was imprisoned in Fort Delaware Prison, which was a masonry fort out on a little island in the middle of the Delaware River. Not long after that, he was among 600 hand-picked Confederate officer prisoners that were sent south under the orders of Secretary of War Stanton as retribution for a perceived mistreatment of Northern troops, say in Andersonville, I believe. The idea being to take 600 Confederate prisoners and mistreat them as badly as they could be mistreated, just as a basically a revenge measure. And these 600 men were put in chains and manacles and put down in the hold of a steamship, a steamer, sent south to Charleston, disembarked in Morris Island, which is just right there around the Charleston Harbor area, at that particular time, Fort Sumter was still in Confederate hands, and they were firing. There was artillery duels going on all day long between Fort Sumter and the Union troops and batteries surrounding Fort Sumter. Well, they took these 600 Confederate officers and put them in a pine stockade, 3 acres, a 3-acre pine stockade right outside of one of the Union forts, so that any shells falling short from the Confederate cannon at Fort Sumter would fall right in and kill their own men. So it was a sort of a little ironic revenge technique. It backfired on them, though, because of all the records that I've been able to read. There were some Confederates wounded, but no Confederates were killed that way, even though several of the Negro guards from the 54th Massachusetts, that was in the movie Glory, mm-hmm. they were detailed to guard these guys on the catwalks that surrounded the stockade. Some of the guards were killed from shrapnel, but none of the Confederates were.
And then how long was it until he was released?
He was eventually sent back to, he went to Fort Pulaski, was in prison at Fort Pulaski, and then they were sent back to Fort Delaware. And he could have been released right away at the end of the war. He could have immediately taken the Oath of Allegiance and walked out of there in April of 1865. But as he explains in his diary, that was a real emotional decision for a lot of these guys to make. They had gone through so much and they felt so strongly about what they were fighting for that it was a dilemma. Some signed the paper, took the oath, and left and went home. But he and a group that he was with held out for, April, May, June, for another 3 months. Finally he said, there's only a few of us left, and I've done my duty for my country, and it's time I do my duty to my family. So.
Now tell me what had happened to the home in the meantime while he was gone.
Well, all I know for a fact is that the house was utilized. I suppose it was lived in by his wife and daughters. And I think
he came back here several times.
Right, he came back on furlough.
And on furlough, so he did visit.
That's
here
true,
once,
yeah.
So his family had to be here.
That's right. I forgot about that. So yeah, they continued to live here. He came visited frequently, or as frequently as he could. And then I guess when news that the Yankees were coming down with Sherman and getting fairly close, it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that armies had to travel close to railroads, because that's where they got their food, supplies, and so forth. And this town sits right on a railroad. Mm-hmm. They knew that they were going to be coming right down the railroad and occupying the town. So.
How close is this house to the railroad tracks? One block.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know in feet or yards, mm-hmm. but it's, 150 yards maybe?
Probably, yeah, because I know it's just a block down to Main Street, mm-hmm. and then there's the railroad track right there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, in any event, they left. I have heard that, I know for a fact that Smith Lemon and his family went to Cuthbert, which is South Georgia.
Is that Cuthbert?
Cuthbert, right. Mm-hmm. It's down at somewhere near Columbus,
down
I think.
Down south mm-hmm. of here.
And anyway, I know that that's where Smith and his family went, and I'm not sure but that maybe Eliza, his wife, went also, but I don't know that. So she may have been here when the Yankees got here and occupied the place, but when they did get here, I think it was in early June of 1864, the army moved into this town and in the surrounding communities as well. I mean, it was a huge army and they were spread all over. But they
was it thousands or hundreds of soldiers?
Oh, there were thousands. Several army corps were involved under Thomas and McPherson and Schofield. The house was, along with a few other houses in this area, this house was utilized as Sherman's Army headquarters and Provost Marshal's office.
Also as a hospital?
Well, that was later.
Later.
The townspeople, when the Yankees had occupied this town, it was under martial law. The only people that could walk up and down the streets were soldiers. And any civilian, townsperson that wanted to go into town for any reason had to have a pass issued and personally signed by the provost marshal. And all the old-timers around this area all say independently of each other that this was the place where their grandfather or their great-uncle or something had to come to get a pass.
This address, right.
This house.
We've been telling it since we've been here.
Yeah. They had to come to this house where the provost marshal would sign the pass, mm-hmm. and then they could walk on up the hill into the town.
Was this the nicest house in town at the time?
Well, that's hard to say because...
I wondered why I picked it. I mean, it's obviously very convenient, being just a block from the main
it's
street.
It's probably one of the nicest and the largest ones.
Largest, mm-hmm. uh-huh.
It's, but you know, I hesitate saying that because so much of this, 90% of this town was burned.
Mm-hmm. So you don't know what was here
in November.
Before,
when Sherman... Later on down in the timeline, when Sherman had already gone down, occupied Atlanta, fought the Battle of Atlanta and all that, and he was packing up and moving towards Savannah, when they moved out of Atlanta, they burned not only Atlanta, people think they just burned Atlanta, but they burned all the towns that anywhere near where this army was located. So in November, they burned Acworth. And
November of 1864?
Mm-hmm, it was burned. That's when they packed up and left.
Now, was that when the fire took place here in this house?
No, that was recent.
Mm-hmm. But this house was not affected then of that fire.
No. And as was the custom before the March to the Sea began, it was sort of it was customary as a civilized gesture to spare any house that the Army had utilized for headquarters or for a hospital. Now that changed during the March to the Sea because that's when Sherman became fairly vindictive and would burn indiscriminately, would burn homes regardless of whether they'd been used or not. But prior to that, when they were in this area, they would spare homes that they would use for any purpose. The Methodist Church right that's now gone, that used to be up on Main Street, that was used as a hospital. This house was used as a hospital also after the Battle of Kennesaw Mountain.
For Confederate soldiers?
No,
for Union soldiers.
They would ship them right off, they would haul them off the battlefield in wagons to the closest community, which would have been Big Shanty. They utilized several structures around there, and then they loaded them onto to troop trains, headed them 6 miles up the line, disembarked here, and used this house and the Methodist Church as a hospital.
So obviously Eliza was not here at that time. Is that true? Or
don't,
you don't know?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I wish I could say.
Do you know what was stolen? Anything was stolen from the house or what the condition of the house was when all that was over with?
No.
Is there any record of that? No.
I can infer, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. I just infer by and assume that they probably... Well, I shouldn't say that. Actually, it all depended on the officer in charge. It depended on the commanding officer in the area. They would often turn a blind eye to that, to looting and pilfering. On the other hand, if he were conscientious and had a little bit of, civilized nature, they would halt the looting and pilfering whenever they saw it and issued strict orders to prevent it. They would many times guard a home issue, or I'm sorry, a post. Armed guards in the house to keep it from being damaged.
Now, whose name is engraved on the front step?
Well, I didn't know who it was at first. His name was, I'd have to go, I think it's Captain L.M. Dayton, D-A-Y-T-O-N. And at the time, that didn't ring a bell with me. I discovered it one day when I was down there rooting around underneath the stairs, kind of trying to reach my arm back in some of the out of the way areas back. I pulled out what a guy told me he thought they may have been linen bandages, but it's strips of linen. I don't know what they were used for. But at the same time I found that stuff, I was looking around and knocking the cobwebs out from underneath the stairs. I noticed the carving underneath the stairs on a stringer, one of the stringers that goes up. And actually, I got a flashlight and showing it on there. The name of it says L.M. Dayton, Captain, June 8th, 1864. And then I started digging through my history books and research, I mean my reference books. And in that process, I determined that Sherman himself was here in this town for, I believe he came here on the 6th. This is right off the top of my head. I'm pretty sure it was he arrived personally in town here on the 6th of June, 1864. Stayed here the 6th, 7th, and 8th, and left the morning of the 9th. And I think went down to Big Shanty, or one of the surrounding communities around here. He didn't stay here very long. His army stayed here for months, but he himself was only here for about 3.5 days.
When did James Lyle Lemon come back to this home?
I don't have a specific day and month or year. I know it was 65, but when he was paroled, he made his way back down here. It would have probably been, it's June, probably August, September time frame. It would have probably taken him 2 or 3 months to walk back here. But the name down there turned out to be one of Sherman's staff officers. General officers would always have a staff of 8 to 10 junior officers that basically tailed them wherever they went in case dispatches had to be sent to some other general. There would always be a little cluster of officers, and he was one of the Sherman staff officers.
And that would tie in, the date tie in with the time that he would have been here.
Mm-hmm.
So then once he came back, then what do you know about the house from that point on, from the time James Lyle returned?
He lived in it, raised a huge family. I think they had 10. I believe he only had 2 girls during the war, and after the war he had the other 8 children, total of 10. They lived here. He was heavily involved in business, local businesses around here.
Staked, do you think, by that buried $5,000?
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And plus just his grit and determination. The guy was just a real... Smith, I've heard and read that Smith was more of a studious, introverted, kind of a, I don't want to say sickly, but he just wasn't really...
Wasn't as outgoing.
In fact, it's been said that he, because of his health, he wasn't really up to the vigor, the rigors of army life and living. So he was in a Georgia Home Guard unit, but wasn't really actively involved in the war, whereas James was more of the dynamic, physical... get up and go type, hard charger and more gregarious and outgoing. It was an interesting contrast in their personalities.
So did he live here then with his family for the rest of his life?
Right. He died in 1907.
We have pictures of him as he had gotten older.
Oh.
Some of his family here.
That's him in the middle on the bottom.
Oh my.
And Mark belongs to the Sons of the Confederacy, and it was through Mark's efforts that he was able, in getting this information about James Lyle and his being wounded and refusing to,
he refused to take the Oath of Allegiance.
Take the Oath of Allegiance.
After he was wounded in return for good food and medical treatment, and basically just told him to go to hell, and he survived it. Anyway, the totality of his experiences, I guess, qualified him. This organization bestowed that medal on him, and they say it's just as difficult to get as the Congressional Medal of Honor. That's the equivalent.
Mm-hmm. Now, what happened to the home after he died in 1907?
He willed the house to his daughter, Mariah, and she married a man named John C. Nichols. And if I'm not mistaken, that John Nichols was in James's unit during the war. He was a veteran that fought under James. John Nichols married his daughter Mariah, and the house passed into the Nichols family at that point in time.
Oh, I see. So that's how the Nichols became owners. Came out of the
I've often wondered, since he had 5 sons, mm-hmm. 1, 2, 3...
James Lyle,
right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now he had 4 sons. why mm-hmm. it wasn't willed to the oldest son. Or
and
whatever.
Then it probably would have stayed
in
the Lemon family,
right.
Now, as I understand it, the house passed through that family, right, down through the years, and then somehow or another, were you always aware of this home, you and your husband?
Yes, we've always been aware of it. My husband came here as a small child when it was then in the Nichols family, and spent several nights as a child here. And so when we would come, the cemetery here, is it Mars Hill?
Liberty Hill.
Where his father and mother and brother all buried over there. And we would come up to the cemetery and then we'd always come by this house. And Mark learned at an early age, maybe when he was in high school, his father would bring him by here and show him this house. And we'd tell him that this was the old family home. And Mark just had a desire from then on, and the more he learned and researched James Lyle, and the more he learned about him, the more he wanted to somehow, in some way, in some year, be able to acquire it back and get it back into the Lemon family. And the people, it changed hands several times, and I don't know the names of them.
Of exactly who owned it, but what meaning this house had to your husband? Did it have,
right.
Did he feel like you felt, Mark? Did he feel compelled to own the home again, or was that really you that had those feelings?
You gonna pass that to me? I really think that he, in the back of his mind, he would love to have owned it and himself, and you know, get mm-hmm. it back in the family. But mm-hmm. I think he thought that it was maybe so far out of reach that perhaps the people that had bought it and had renovated it for 10 years, that when they got finished, that they were in no way going to sell it. But during these 10 years that they were doing this, Mark was constantly in touch with them. He, even though he didn't live here or live in Atlanta, he lived the last few years in North Carolina. But wherever he was in contact with them, either by phone or by letter, or when he was in Atlanta visiting us, he'd come by here to see them, and always, always telling them if they ever wanted to sell it, please give us first choice. And although that was just something so far-fetched, you know, that we would ever be able to be even offered it.
I mean, you just didn't think it was
possible. We didn't think it was possible, but Mark had more of, he had that burning desire, I think, to get it back, as well as Frank did, but he just kept at it. He just wasn't going to, Mark did. Mm-hmm. He just wasn't going to give up. When he found that this house was auctioned, two off, you know, when the Corbins bought it, he just...
85.
In 85, he was just beside himself. He said, had we known it was even for sale, we didn't know that it was auctioned off? Right, and that this young couple had bought it, and Mark thought then, well, you know, they bought this home and they're going to completely renovate. There'll be no way.
Fairly young, have a family.
Right.
They're probably going to be entrenched here for
from
20,
now?
30 years or more.
But
was that devastating to you to find that out?
It was, because I remember him telling me that he just thought then it was completely out of reach.
And I'll be honest with you, I don't mind saying this at all. I didn't feel right. I never felt right about any other family living in this house.
He resented the fact that
someone
else was here.
I know there's no rationale in saying this, but it's just an emotional
mm-hmm.
feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel like anybody else had the right to live here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what kept me
bugging them,
nipping at these people's heels to, you know, hey, I'm still here. You want to move yet?
Yeah. And I think, I don't know whether they just completed the renovation, and this was a challenge to them, and that's what they bought it for. And it was a project, and once they accomplished it, then they were ready to move on. I don't know whether that was the reason that they decided to sell, or whether the fact that Mark just kept after them, they might as well give in to this
plus
stuff.
Plus, they knew they had a guaranteed sale.
Right. They knew they didn't have to put it on the market. They knew they didn't have to pay the real estate fee. They had a definite buyer. So in January, when they called Mark and told him that they had decided to buy, then we got a call from Mark, and he was really excited. This is very important. You've got to hear this. You know, that
when was that,
Mark? January of this year, 1993.
Well, I got suspicious when I received an invitation to the December open house, because they had had these things for 10 years, and I'd never received an invitation before. You know, then they knew how to get in touch with me.
Sure.
But I never received one. Suddenly, I get an invitation in December to come to one, and unfortunately I couldn't go. But a month later, he personally called me and asked me if I was still interested. And so I knew that something, you know, I had figured that something was about to happen. Mm-hmm. And that's when I talked to them about doing this.
Now you, Mrs. Lemon, you and your husband were living in another part of Georgia. You were both retired at the time.
Yes.
And so what did this mean to you financially?
Well, when my husband had this stroke about 10 years ago, when we were living in the mountains at the time, and we then had to move to Grayson, which is right outside, right there at Snellville, to be closer to the doctors and in the hospital and so forth. And we thought then that that was going to be the last move that we would make. That was it. No more moving, you know. And had no idea of moving because we didn't think this house was not an option to us then. It was just something that we would like to have, and we were sorry somebody else was living there, but you know, there's nothing we can do about it. But as it worked out, when he called and told us this, that it was going to be
Mark
called and told us that it was going to be they were going to put it up for sale and offered it to us first. Then that meant that we had to some way sell the house, and if we could even get what we hopefully we could get out of it, would not be enough to acquire this house. So my husband not being able to help me with this financial arrangement, he tried to help me in telling mm-hmm. me what we needed to do, and between him and between Mark helping and sort of spurring us on, you know, I realized that I had to get a certain amount out of the house, and I realized that through liquidating some bonds and that we had municipal bonds and some savings that we had, if we could get a certain amount out of the house and get this other money together with the two things happening, we might be able to buy. And my husband, at our age, we didn't want to start off having a monthly mortgage payment, you know, because we hadn't had one for years and years because we bought each house by after we acquired our first house on Claremont Road, and we were able to sell that house and build another one with that money, and when we sold that house, we paid cash for the one in Grayson. So at this point in time of our lives, we didn't want to have to start off with a huge mortgage payment. So we were trying to get the money together to pay for this house down, you know, cash down, and not have this big mortgage. And that was quite a feat in itself, trying to get that worked out.
Yeah.
What, because I was trying to, we had financed the house on Claremont Road where we had lived, and we were trying to get those people to refinance that house so we'd get our money out of that house. We had them, and which took 3 months for them to do that. And I had gotten all the other money together. I was waiting on this in order to be able to close. And actually, at the closing, I didn't have this money in my hand. It was in the process. And we were able to go ahead and close within, you know, I think it was, 30 days that they were going to allow us to get the balance, which was amazing.
So it took everything you had.
It took everything we had to do it. And you'd have to know my husband to know, you know, that he would have to have wanted this house very, very,
yeah.
very much to have given up, because he's the one that has saved all his life and believed in saving. He's tried to instill that in Mark and always saving. And if it hadn't been for that, we wouldn't have had the money to have done it. But to give that up, his life savings, to give that up and put it into the old home place, you know, it speaks for itself in saying how much he really wanted it, because
he would have never done it.
He would have never, ever done it for anything else, for any other reason.
How has your husband reacted to living here in home?
Oh, he's really enjoying it. It was quite a change, I mean, to say the least, because we had settled in there. He had gotten a routine together, whether he would he would get up in the morning and go down to the drugstore where a lot of the retired group men would meet, you know. So he had that little camaraderie there with them, which he needed after being just cut off from not being able to do anything. You know, that he was always very active in building everything, doing. He was able to take care of the car, do anything on the car, the build, the house, whatever. And then suddenly not to be able to do any of this. And then to, it helped him to be able to go and be with other men, you know. And that association was good for him. And they understood his situation about his speech having difficulty in speaking, so they would draw him out, you know, and so it was a good a thing for him to have that fellowship there with those men, and that worried me a lot because I thought, you know, this is what he needs, and if we move up here, but I knew too that he knew a lot of people that had lived here. He knew maybe their descendants were still here, and it just worked out that we have since gotten him started in another group down at one of the little cafes on Main Street. That we were just down there one morning for coffee, and two elderly gentlemen just started talking to us, and come to find out they knew Frank's father's father. So it just started that way, and now he's getting more into the community and getting the feel of this place and the peaceful existence here. It's just, you know, we were right there off of 78, and it was just such a the traffic was just
typical modern subdivision.
Oh yeah,
houses right up next to it.
We were all three streets off of there, but you know, we weren't right in the middle of it. But we had to get on there to go anywhere, and it had gotten to be such a chore that we just didn't go most of the time just to avoid that. But being here in this community is more laid back. It's more peaceful. You have people all around you, but and they're good neighbors. They do anything for you, but they don't bother you. You know, they'll stop by if you're in the front yard and speak to you, and they bring you stuff, you know, baked goods, and when we moved in and that sort of thing. But yet we have the convenience too, mm-hmm. you know, in Marietta and Kennesaw of the stores if we need to go there. But
was it worth it? Everything that you went through?
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You wonder?
Mm-hmm.
I do. I really do, and I think if you'd asked him if he would do it again, I think he'd say yes too.
Mm-hmm.
Because you wonder, it was such a big change. And I told Mark, I said, I'd lay in bed sometimes and wonder, and worry about doing it. Is this the thing we should do? You know, if we get up there in that big house, you know, will we like it? Will things work out for us? Will we be sorry then? We spent our life savings and everything, you know.
Well, and you were also worried about your husband's health.
That's right. And I didn't know what the change would do to him in that respect, you know.
But I tell you, I always knew, and I told you this the other day, I knew you were worried about that, but I always knew, knowing the history of this family in this town, I never had any doubts but that when y'all came
you'd
up
be
here,
readily accepted.
You're, just the name recognition alone would get people to
mm-hmm.
be friendly to you,
mm-hmm.
and that's exactly what's happened. People, you know, have been real friendly and genuinely friendly, have stopped by. And they've been welcomed with open arms around this place.
What has it meant to you? Has it been, is it as good as you thought? I mean, is it a dream come true and it's just as good as you thought it would be? Because you seem to have a very serious attitude about it. I mean, you've obviously, I'm very impressed with your knowledge of your great-grandfather's life and experiences and so forth, and you have many artifacts here in the home of pictures and a family tree and Civil War diary and so forth, and obviously you take all this very seriously.
Yes.
He takes it so seriously that he's given up his job there in North Carolina to move here.
Is that right?
He tried to get transferred through the government, and they're just not transferring, you know, even mainly because of his father's health. And
now, you did tell me that your will was such that the house would go to Mark.
That's the first thing.
Free and
clear. Uh-huh. First thing that we did when we moved here. We have a daughter, but she's just not interested in the house. She's not interested in things like that. Anything old is a clunker, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a
plan. Many people feel that.
And Mark is just entirely opposite.
Mark, when did your interest in your great-grandfather and all of your history that the house was in, when did all that begin when you were small?
Well, I thought about that, and the only thing that I can picture in my mind as the first memory of him or being talked about
mm-hmm.
is when we would go up to Powder Springs
mm-hmm.
and visit my grandfather,
mm-hmm.
Elvin Lemon. And we would usually go up on a weekend and have Sunday, or on Sunday
mm-hmm.
and have Sunday
mm-hmm.
dinner there.
Mm-hmm.
And I clearly remember sitting around the dinner table, either eating or just as dinner was being finished. And my dad and my grandfather would be talking about him, about James Lemon and his experiences. And that's the first time that I had ever heard that he was wounded. Now, the story had been changed slightly from word of mouth over the years, and to the point where they said that his wound was instead of being shot through the neck, he was shot through one ear and came out the other ear. And I was probably seven or eight years old when I heard this, and I thought that was just the neatest thing I'd ever heard of in my life. And I, you know, I'd hear about how he was a soldier and was captured and wounded, and I guess that just really put the hook in me when I heard that stuff, and I wanted to know more about it. And
so you were very proud of your heritage then.
I tell you something else. I don't know how much this is pertinent to what you want to know, but it has a big influence on me. I began when I grew up in the 60s and 70s, there was a lot of a lot of rewriting of history, and a lot of shame being brought down on the South from media, from Hollywood producers, and I guess this mainly manifested itself in miniseries or TV shows or books or articles or whatever. And I started realizing that that the popular cultural atmosphere at the time was one that was such that it was a shameful thing to be from the South.
Because of slavery, you mean?
Because of slavery, because we lost the war, because it's always a tendency of somebody that beat somebody else in the war to gloat, I guess. But at the very least, the victors get to write the history books. And so their side of it is always the one that prevails. Their side of the story is the one that gets published, basically, and gets the official sanction of the government. And I began to get really sick and tired of being made to feel shameful and embarrassed for being a Southerner, for being from the South. I got teased when I went, in school. I went to high school with kids from in Atlanta, but the kids were from all over the country. It was a highly urban environment. Kids from all over Massachusetts, New England, Midwest, and I would be made. You know, here I was in my backyard, basically, so to speak, being made fun of because I was from the South. Joined the Navy. People always used to ask me when I had my last plate of grits and stuff like that. I don't want to hear it anymore. I became, just over my lifetime, I've just been inundated with this guilt trip. And I think it's not just me. I think it's a lot of Southerners feel this way. They might not express it, but a lot of us feel this way. And I found, the more I read about that man and what he did, there is no way that I'm ever going to be ashamed of him or what he fought for. As an example, in his will, he left a sizable amount of money. I don't think it's specified. It's basically a interest gained on stocks that he has and so forth. It's not a specific numerical value, but he left a sizable amount of money to the poor blacks in his community when he died. Somehow that doesn't fit into the neat little peg in a hole stereotypes that a lot of people want to make out of Southerners or Confederate soldiers, that they were all raving racists and had, out with a whip cracking over the slaves. You know, that's not true. That's not the way it was, at least not with this man. He was kind-hearted, and he was a good man. And that's just a sort of an undercurrent that runs through my feeling about this house and everything, is that I'm proud of being a Southerner. I'm proud of being his great-great-grandson, and living in his house is just a celebration of that.
He also left and helped organize the First Presbyterian Church here, but he left at the time, I think, $10,000 to that church, and to this day they're still drawing interest on it.
It was 123 years ago.
Right. Mr. Abbott, one of the men that we met down here, he was in charge of that at one time there at the church, and he was telling me that they still draw interest from the money that was left to that church down here. So it gives you a good feeling that he still is doing good, even though he's been gone a long time.
Well, it sounds like in many ways, Mark, that you've reclaimed your pride, your sense of identity, and your sense of worth as a person and as a man and as a Southerner through the history of your great-great-grandfather that, as you can document what his life was really like, and now you're reclaiming the home place, but that's given you a whole sense of purpose. Gives your life meaning. Seems
right.
Like it does.
Right.
But it's more important to him than anything right now. His family and this home here mm-hmm. is more important to him than the time that he spent with the Navy that was bridged over to the government job he has now. He's willing to give up to come
so
down
you are
here.
Going to give up your job and move
yeah.
down here?
I've resigned effective 20 December.
And that's just because this house is here and you want to be nearby and
no, it's no, that's only secondary. The primary reason is my dad's health is very, very bad. And my mom's right leg is, her right knee has no cartilage left in it, so it's painful for her to move around a whole
mm-hmm.
lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a matter of, I'm needed around here. It doesn't bother me that I'm needed. I don't mind it a bit, the fact that I want to be here to help out. And I can't in good conscience lay in my bed 500 miles away from here day after day knowing that there's things that I need to be doing around here to help out.
Well, you have been coming. Did you tell me that you've been coming almost
every
other weekend
right.
since you acquired the house?
And it's hard, you know, to travel.
Right,
that's an 8-hour trip
right.
and try to keep up a home and job mm-hmm. in another place and then try to come here and work so hard on the weekend and go back. It's just too much for him. And I hate for him to give up this time that he has that would go toward his retirement. I hate to see him do that.
Sounds like you set his priority.
I don't think I could change his mind if I tried, so I've not tried.
It's just a job.
I think when he sets his mind to something,
he's
going to
do it.
Follows through.
He's like his father, like in that respect.
Mark, you told me when we were walking around the house that you were spending some time up in the rafters trying to outline the initial layout of the house.
Right.
Is that ongoing, or have you pretty much figured everything out about that?
I'm still learning things about this place, and in fact, I just last night made another discovery that slightly changed my original ideas. But I'm just about 90% sure of the original layout of the place, the way it looked, the way the stylings, the way the roof looked, and so forth. And then not only that, but then the progression of alterations and changes that were made over the next 137 years. There have been a lot of them, some minor and some major. But yeah, I've been able to by getting up in the attic, down in the cellar and underneath the foundation quite a bit, and taking notes and doing drawings, I've been able to date various parts of the house and then fit the pieces together to form a rational.
What he's working on in connection with that is these drawings that he's been able to determine how the house originally looked with a hip roof, which is entirely different from the way it is now, and what it looked like originally. And then through the years, by his series of drawings that he's doing. Then in 1870 or so, it looked like this, and then on down until the present day.
For instance, when he came back from the war, they started him back in business, got money flowing in again, raised a larger family. They knocked out the rear hallway here, extended this hallway about 15 feet or so, and added what you saw is what's now the laundry room, and then a room right across from it that would have been the exact same
mm-hmm.
size. And I've been able to pretty much speculate that because he had more kids then, and it was consistent with the way houses were built and designed back then, to have a large main dining room and then have an area for the kids to eat in, and that would have corresponded perfectly with
mm-hmm.
a children's dining room / pantry. And then maybe the one across the hall right over in here being, my dad thinks it might have been a boarding room, which also fits in with being close to the kitchen. He wanted it to be warm and close to a source of water. That's
just...
where
the children were born.
Right.
Right.
That's just...
Well, with 12 children,
well,
they
had
a room for
yeah.
10 children.
Yeah.
And
right.
Room
and
that.
I imagine it was used quite often, apparently.
So, say...
Well, I was especially interested in, you showed me what you called and thought was a fire escape upstairs that goes down the three stories from the
mm-hmm.
second to the first to the basement to the cell. Is that a straight shoot down, or are there stairs? Would you
no.
just jump in there and
no.
fall
yeah.
for the story?
No. Oh, no.
quite
I didn't mean to give that impression. You, there are big, heavy, square spikes still in the studs of the interior walls, right underneath what would have been the trap door in that closet.
In the master bedroom.
In the master bedroom, going straight down the studs, which is where the ladder would have been spiked on there onto the studs.
You would have been climbing down the ladder.
Mm-hmm. And then you will set foot down on the floor inside, and I'll show you later, inside on the first floor, and then you have to lift up another panel and go into the cellar. So
it could have been for hiding, or it could have been for a fire, or
It was definitely not an accident. It wasn't an accidental
feature.
But there
for a purpose.
Because it's just obvious by looking at the details of construction that it was planned that
way. Right. If you pulled up the trap door in the closet, you'd be able to escape a fire that was just set on the stairs. Tell me just for a minute about the fire that did take place in the house. When was that?
Well, that ended the occupation of the house by the Nichols family, basically. It was in 1975. An elderly lady by the name of Grace Nichols and her daughter Sarah, who I think was a school teacher.
Ackworth High.
Died in a fire here in this house in 1975.
Both of them died?
Right. They apparently were overcome by smoke and heat and were unable to get out of the house. It occurred right outside this doorway, in fact.
In the hall. They were staying in the hall. They had their chairs and so forth in the hall, and the other rooms apparently closed off.
Well, because to conserve heat.
Probably.
And do you know how the fire started? Was it a heat source?
Well, I think it was a cigarette.
I understand it was a cigarette, and they had I think the daughter was staying home that day. She'd normally been at work, but she was staying home that day sick for some reason. She had taken medication, so it could have been that she was not aware of the fire until it got out of control, and maybe the mother had fallen asleep or something of that sort. So we don't really know all the details, but we do have articles that different people have given us of the pictures of the fire and what took place.
Has that ever given you a strange feeling of sleeping in the home that two people died here?
No. You know, I thought
probably a lot of people died here during the war.
Well, sure. That they did with the Yankee soldiers being here. I'm sure there's a lot of deaths that went on.
But there doesn't seem to be any. I mean, I don't know, maybe you don't believe in such things, but any negative spirit?
I joke about it.
Well, we joke about it, you know, and I tell Mark, I said, you know, we stay down here and we watch TV till about 11 or 12 and we turn everything off and then we head upstairs, you know, and usually Frank has already gone to bed before I come up and sometimes I get sort of a weird feeling walking through the whole thing, well, you know, this is where two people died, but, you know, and then I start up the steps and I think I hear a little squeaking or something, but it's probably the, you know, how the house shifts sometimes and you hear something like that. But it really doesn't bother me.
It sounds like, though, there's a little something tweaks you as you come through here. I can understand that.
Other people have said, I don't think I can live. Yeah, but, you know, people live in houses that probably other people have died in that they don't know about.
Anytime you have a house that's almost 140 years old, somebody's going to have died in the place. You know?
It's only a recent phenomenon that we choose to die in hospitals. Used to be people did die in homes.
And I'm sure there's been many more births in this home than there's ever been deaths.
There's been a lot of happy things going on.
Oh, yeah, a lot of happy things.
There have been three golden wedding anniversaries celebrated
here
in this house.
Right here in this room with
one
the bay window.
James and his wife.
Golden is 50 years.
Right.
We hang on long enough, we'll have another one here.
Is that right?
That's right.
When will that happen? What year?
Well, we were married in 49, so we've got a ways to go yet.
So
only
6
years.
If we can, when you think of it, 6 years is not very long.
No,
if we could have another, that would really mean a lot.
Wouldn't that be exciting?
Be great, yeah.
So,
his dad's always saying, oh, you know, be gone by then. And I said, yeah, you're going to outlive us all. You're going to outlive us all.
That's right, you never know.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, there's been a lot of nice memories here, too. So we choose to look at that side rather than the other, but it doesn't bother us at all. It doesn't bother me.
Your Civil War paintings are beautiful. Do you continue that as a special interest? Do you paint other things? And I also understand from your mom that you're going to try to get a Lemon Museum going in Ackworth.
Well, he's not trying to get it.
Who's that? Clarify that for me. I listened to it.
Not in Ackworth. You speaking of Ackworth?
No. You told me.
What I told you was that they're trying to get a museum off the square in Marietta. You know, at the Kennesaw House. That they're trying to, I think, acquired a floor there that will be used as a Civil War museum, and that is where the his Medal of Honor, James Knox Medal of Honor, will be housed. And Mark, the painting that he's going over today to pick up, it's over at a gallery near Northlake, is the painting that he did in which where he was actually
shows
wounded.
Him kind of
wounded.
Going over the top of that fort with his men. Getting.
And so that will be the painting that Mark will donate to the museum as well.
And so that's really a combination of your research and diaries and so
mm-hmm.
forth, and
right.
then your own imagination of trying to put that into a picture.
It's very, actually, it's very little imagination.
All
there
of
it's
been
some,
research,
but,
everything in that
but
picture.
But every place I've painted, I've gone there and using either the official records, a combination of the official records, his diary, and other sources, mm-hmm. have actually physically gone to that spot and mm-hmm. in 360-degree photographed it. And so I know, what, and I even get the weather, what the weather was like on that particular day, and so that I can get as close to authentic as I can on these paintings.
Even the belt buckles, the buttons, the rifles, everything that he is in that picture and in that painting has been researched to know that that was what they used and wore at that time.
But what I'm doing, the overall thing that I'm doing basically is using all this data from the diary, and I'm using the diary as the core or the foundation of a regimental history for the 18th Georgia that's not been written yet. Being one of the most famous and the best regiment, one of the best regiments from Georgia, there's been no regimental history done on it, and that's what the paintings serve as illustrations for the book, if it ever comes out. That's a long time from now, but they will serve as illustrating various events.
And then this beautiful painting that you did of James Lyle, but did you say, Mrs. Lumman, that he gave that to you as a housewarming gift?
Well, actually, it was at the closing, when we had the closing, yes, it was like
right
a housewarming.
Right over the fireplace.
And he did some beautiful script writing on the back that it was presented to Mark and Frank, Lemon, on the occasion of reacquiring the Lemon House.
So
I don't
know.
I don't
know. Somebody that pulls that down and looks at it, they'll be able to tell, who did it and why it was done.
But I want to get a little plaque, a little brass plaque, so that you won't have to take it down to look at the back, and I want to put it on the front so everybody can see that.
Is there anything that you wanted to add that we haven't gone over? Seems very thorough to me. How do you feel about it?
I feel the same.
Yeah, me too. I think you've covered it pretty well. Mark, and you can see why I wanted Mark to be here, because he's done the research and knows more of the facts than I do. And it just wouldn't have been an interview without him, because I couldn't have told you all this
mm-hmm.
in no way.
There was a real special moment last month when we had this open house here in October when, is it Dad's nephew? Dorothy?
Yes, his niece.
His niece and her husband, Johnny Stanford, brought over the Bible of George.
This Bible that this was given to you by your father, by Mr. Lemon's niece.
Right.
Last year, on the occasion of an open house here,
it was just last month.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And the open house, and
right.
Tell me about that, how that ceremony went.
It was a pretty large affair. What do we have?
I'd say
maybe 80 to 100 people here.
I would
here.
Think so, off and on during the day.
Johnny and Dorothy Stanford, Dorothy being my dad's niece, came by and while they were here, Johnny pulled me over to one side and told me that he had something he was going to give to my dad, but he wanted to wait a few minutes until the appropriate time, and then
he wanted all of us to be together.
Basically just wanted me to give. He gave me a heads up that he was about to do it, and so then when my dad came in there, and everybody sort of was gathered in the parlor. He had my dad sit down, and he had me open it for him because it's hard for him to use both of his hands. And I opened it, and immediately knew it was something old by looking at it. Then he said that it was George, meaning George Lee Lemon, my dad's grandfather. It was his Bible, and something like that, personal Bible belonging to his grandfather. Mm-hmm. That's something he had, I don't think, even ever seen before.
What a treasure.
I don't think he even knew it was in existence.
It just was, it was pretty overwhelming emotionally. And, he stood up and sort of cried a little bit and hugged Dorothy
and Johnny.
And Johnny, too. So it was really nice. People were all kind.
Yeah, there were people all in the room and in the hallway, and it was so emotional, and he just couldn't contain it. He just broke down.
Have you found that people in the family have been giving you artifacts?
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
That's starting
now that you have the home.
Oh, yeah. Yep. People calling and telling us, well, in fact, Bill Lemon, one of the Lemons, had some books where there was an account of James Lyman.
Confederate military history of Georgia.
Right, and he had three volumes of that he's bringing to us and giving us. And
so you started sort of a museum right
like
here, haven't you?
It's almost like a museum. And then every week or so, we'll have someone at the door. And just the other day, I went to the door, and there was these two young fellows, in their 40s, 45, I guess, years old, and they were standing there, and I had no idea who they were. And he introduced himself as being one of the descendants of James Lyle, and that he lived. He was in Auburn, Alabama. He lived in Auburn. His mother lived in Columbia, South Carolina, I believe.
Okay.
Columbia, and he told me that he had been here as a small child, and he was just up in the air and just thought, just that on a whim, if he could find the house, and he saw the house and knew it right away. Wanted to come in. He was with an ex-roommate of his at Auburn. They came in, and I showed them the whole house, and they were just thrilled to death. And his mother, and I had been given back this summer a card by one of the Nichols and told me to get in touch with his mother in Columbia, that she had done extensive research on this house and could give me a lot of information. And he told me, I didn't connect the two till I ran across the car. And I said, "Well, this is his mother that she was telling me to get in touch with." And he told me while he was here that his mother had a Bible that belonged to James Lyle that had a metal cover on it that he carried in his breast pocket inside his uniform. That he thought that after seeing the house and what we have here and the other artifacts that we have and articles, that he knew that Bible belonged here. And we're going to try to have another open house in before Christmas, and I have received a letter from his mother since then, and so he said he's going to do his best to get her to turn that Bible over to us. So we're going to have a collection of Bibles here.
Yeah, we already have one from him.
This is one of the Bibles
he carried. He signed it in pencil in here, Company A, 18th Georgia, and then in the back, somebody has written, "Given to me by Captain James Lemon." So that we know this is one of his. Of course, kids have scribbled all over the inside of it.
So he gave it to someone, mm-hmm. and then it somehow came back into
right.
the family.
Right.
So this house, not just the people, not just you people, because
mm-hmm.
you've been alive and around,
right.
but it's actually you owning the house, the combination of you
That's
being
right.
in the home, has inspired all of this gift giving
it
and
has.
All of these wonderful acquisitions.
And this earlier this summer, we had someone. We just saw a young couple out here taking pictures. Just go. Oh, we see that quite often anyway. We didn't think a whole lot about it. But then Frank saw them, and he invites everybody in, you know. And so come to find out, they were related to the Nichols, and they lived. His father lived in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. And they were from Arkansas, and they wanted to take pictures, and had a stroke back some time ago, and wanted to take some pictures of the house inside and out. And when he found out it had been acquired back into the Lemon family, then he was just, he was thrilled at that to be able to take pictures and go back and show. So almost every month or every few weeks or so, someone will come to the door that has been a relative or knows of someone or has known this house in the past. And another thing that I've noticed that this house has been closed off to people in this community for the last 10 years, and since it's been put back in order, they of course were not interested in it historically, so it was not open to these people. People have lived here all their lives and never been in this house, and we made it available to them when we had the open house to be able to come in here and see this house, because it means a lot to the people in this community, because it's a historical house and it's part of the community, and yet they had never been able to see it. So there were so many neighbors and friends that were able to come in then when we had the open house and see it for the first time.
I noticed looking through this Bible, first of all, it looks well loved, doesn't it?
Yes.
But I'm also noticing many passages are highlighted mm-hmm. with pencil mm-hmm. checks and so forth. Is there?
Mm-hmm.
Some of this, I was reading this one, "But thou hast fully known my doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, charity, and patience."
And I guess I just happened to see that in Timothy that is highlighted here with a star, and I wonder if maybe that's what James Lyle, how he got through his suffering in the war is by finding passages. I guess that's my fantasy.
Finding passages in the Bible. I think it's well based because I think he was, you could tell from his letters that he wrote to his wife how he loved his family and what a good man he was and his faith in God, I think, is what got him through because he mentioned that in some of his letters. That letter that we have up here on the wall is the letter that was found in a bunch of nickels of papers in the basement when we got the house, and the people were fixing to throw them out. And Mark said, for goodness sakes, let me go through them first. The first thing Frank picked up was a letter from James Lyle that he wrote to his wife when he was a prisoner, and that's it up on the wall.
So by luck.
Just by
luck. It sounds like more than luck. It sounds almost to me like this was all meant to happen. I don't know if you believe in such things.
I absolutely do. I think that sometimes, you know, like I said, you don't know whether it's a thing to do or not when you're doing it, but once you do it, you get that good feeling, this is where I should be, and this is the way it should be.
And it has turned out to be true, hasn't it?
I think I believe in it. I firmly do. Mm-hmm. And it's just that, it just seemed like, now that we're here, everybody that we see, I'm so glad it's back in the Lemon family, and that you're here again in the house, and that if I have so-and-so I want to give you to put with your other things that you have, you know, so that's just the way it's sort of evolved.
Right. Well, are we finished?
If you are.
This is a diary entry after the interview. This needs to be typed, but on a separate piece of paper, not part of the interview itself. The interview took place Saturday from 1 p.m. until 3 o'clock p.m., November 19, 1993, at the residence. Speaking on the interview were Martha Lemon, in her 60s, Mark Lemon, her son, a 38-year-old male. Frank Lemon, the 70s husband, did not participate in the interview. One spelling of Cuthbert, Georgia, C-U-T-H-B-E-R-T. When I first arrived at the home, we took a tour of both floors. The house was immaculate. Housekeeping condition, furnished with what Mark and Martha said were recently purchased antiques, many of them from an antique dealer in Ackworth named Beverly G, G-E-E. Martha said several times that they had relocated from a ranch house and few of their furnishings seemed appropriate to the home. None of the original furnishings remain. Frank stepped into the interview during the last 2 or 3 minutes only. He has a right side paralysis and speech is difficult for him. But he just came in and sat with us for a minute and then helped escort me to the door, seemed very friendly. On the way out, Mrs. Lemon asked me, Martha asked me where I was from, where was I raised, and I told her New Hampshire. And she laughed. She looked a little uncomfortable and so did Mark, and she laughed and said that during the interview, while they were talking about things, that she sat there thinking, I bet this woman is a Yankee. And she felt like maybe they had offended us, offended me. And I told her that nothing that she had said and nothing that they had said or done had offended me in the least. As we stepped out onto the porch, they invited me to a Christmas open house and asked for my name and address so they could send me an invitation. All in all, it was a lovely interview. They were as warm and personable as they could be. They really wanted to do a good job. Mark, I was especially fascinated with him. He is a police officer at a military base, and I had several very brief conversations with him over the telephone. I expected him to be quite officious and domineering, and it was just the opposite. He was a very empathic and very sensitive person. He got very emotionally involved in the interview and gave it everything he had, and I was surprised. I had experienced some anticipation, some anxiety on approaching the interview because I had spoken with Mrs. Lemon several times in the past and she's quite a talkative person and I was afraid that she was going to take over and that he was going to be a dominant military type and
Both of those assumptions were totally false on my part. I enjoyed the interview. It was one of the best that I think that I've done. That's the end.